what I hope we can do with our work is give people informed consent around if this, then that, right? Here's what we know. If you engage in this behavior, then this is the likely outcome. If we have this test result, then this is the potential implication, right? And then you get to decide for yourself and for your family what makes sense, right? We are not here to give the, you know, this is the should. We're here to give you information so that you can make whatever choice.
Yeah, informed consent so you feel empowered in your health decisions.
Hi, and welcome to the Endo Babe podcast. I'm your host, Chelsea Bree. I'm an ultrasound tech turned endometriosis coach, positivity and self-love advocate, a 7 on the Enneagram, and I am a proud dog mom. And I'm on a mission to help you live more positively with endometriosis and be happy in your body. On the Endo Babe podcast, we're going to dive deep into all things endometriosis, mindset, self-love, health, and so much more. This is a badass podcast for badass endo babes, and I want you to leave this podcast feeling inspired and empowered on your own health journey with more confidence and the belief that you too can have more good days than bad. Are you with me, babes? See you in the podcast.
This episode is brought to you by MJoy. MJoy is an audio well-being app specialized in female pleasure and sexual wellness with science-backed content. Their purpose is to normalize female sexual well-being as a key part of wider well-being and self-care. MJoy is helping over 300,000 women achieve sexual well-being goals such as increasing their libido, climaxing consistently, learning new techniques, and having more fulfilling relationships. The app has over 500 audios of science-backed content created by sex and relationship experts. With over 200 sexy stories, they also have fantasies for any desire. Whether you're new to exploring yourself, wanting to spice things up, or just wanting to improve your mental health and self-care routine, MJoy has something for you. There's even a collection about endometriosis by yours truly in the app. And for EndoBabe podcast listeners, we have teamed up to give you a free 14-day trial of the app. Click the link in the show notes to get your free trial now. Hello, and welcome to another episode of the EndoBabe podcast. This episode, I chatted with Alexandria DeVito, who's the CEO and founder of Poplin, which is basically the first pre-pregnancy company. And they help you get ready to get pregnant through the most comprehensive pre-pregnancy wellness lab testing for couples, men and women, just to help you get your body ready to conceive. We had a wonderful conversation and shared a lot of information about the different categories, because I know a lot of people think that infertility or fertility issues are mostly hormonal, but she talked about blood type and status, immune status, hormone status, metabolic status, and nutrient status. And she gave some tips on how to optimize those to improve egg quality, to improve sperm quality. And it was overall just a really wonderful conversation. I think you're going to really enjoy her. Let's get into the episode. Welcome, Alexandria. I'm so excited that you're here.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm super excited to be here with you.
Of course. So I usually get started by having you share who you are and how you got doing what you're doing now.
So I am the founder of a company called Poplin, and we are the first pre-pregnancy wellness company for couples. We help you get ready to get pregnant. So a little bit of a different take on the whole concept of fertility most of the time, which is addressed in the context of infertility, which I'm sure we'll get into. And how did I get to building a company around pre-pregnancy wellness? I started my early career in healthcare consulting. I worked with a lot of healthcare companies for a bunch of years. And then I went back to school. I got my MBA from Harvard. And then I also did a master's in nutrition part-time on the side. And then I started working as a clinical nutritionist, did training in functional medicine. I went really deep on the clinical side. And what ended up happening was I had a lot of clients that were struggling to conceive. And they were coming to me after a year of trying or 2 years of trying, having been poked and prodded and tested and done all the things. And they were looking for help and guidance and support. And they were coming to me as a nutritionist to say, what else can you offer? Do you have any other suggestions? Can you help? And because I have master's in nutrition and because I had training in functional medicine, I probably did something different than a lot of other nutritionists might have done, but I started running lab tests and I started running really broad sets of lab tests. And we started catching things that their providers had not caught. So things like undiagnosed autoimmune condition, for example, or vitamin and nutrient deficiencies, or, you know, thyroid dysfunction, things like that, that was never caught on the journey. And so a lot of times, right, it was unexplained infertility, but I would argue that it actually was not yet explained infertility. And that was really the impetus. Once I started seeing this over and over and over again and realized we were able to uncover things that were impeding their journey to getting pregnant, and that once addressed, they were able to get pregnant, I realized, wow, there's a better way here. And we can be doing a lot of this testing upfront. And so what we do at Poplin is we run a lot of the screening tests that I was doing later into the stages of infertility upfront on both reproductive partners at the start, so we can identify any red flags or yellow flags that could interfere not only with your ability to conceive, but also to have a healthy baby. So that was my journey to building.
And that's just incredible. And I know it's so needed in the world right now. I feel like almost everybody I talk to knows somebody or is currently struggling with trying to conceive.
Mm-hmm. It's becoming more and more popular. It's wild to me. And certainly while this was happening in the clinic with a lot of my clients, it was also happening with a lot of my friends. And, you know, they were coming to me over coffee or over drinks and, you know, whispering in my ear, can I get your help? Or what can I do? I don't know what to do. I'm exasperated here. So it's very personal to me as well, because I've seen it happen not only with a lot of my clients, but with so many of my friends.
Yeah, it definitely hits close to me as well. I know a lot of people struggling with it. And then my husband and I have also been trying to get pregnant for like the last 5 months. Mm-hmm. And I say like trying, you know,
not trying, trying.
Yeah. But it is what it is, you know? And we're working on it. I actually took the quiz on your website.
Oh, I love it.
Yeah. And I have thyroid issues. So I think that that's really like hindering me right now. Cause I was already like doing a lot of the things that it asked about, which is good. But it was incredible going through that quiz, like how many things there are that can hinder you conceiving a child, right?
It's absolutely true. I mean, this is, you know, first of all, I didn't, for anyone who's listening, I didn't know any of this before I started researching it, even with two degrees, like two master's degrees, right? So it was an incredibly humbling process for me as well to realize how, you know, little I knew about my own body, and also how little just we're taught, right? If you think about the last time we had any sort of health education or sexual education, most of us were, you know, in our preteens or teens, and a lot of that information, right, hasn't been upgraded. If you have a fantastic provider, in some cases they will share some of this information with you, but a lot of times, through no fault of their own, they don't have the time to spend, you know, demystifying cycles and demystifying fertility. And so what ends up happening is there's a vacuum for that information. And, you know, when in my clinical experience, what I found is there's five different categories of health that actually can impact fertility. So that's what we're looking at, right? So you have blood type and status, you have hormone status, immune status, metabolic status, and nutrient status. And so instead of a lot of other tests out there that are looking at just hormones, right, that's about 30% of the equation. We're looking at, you know, the other 70% of the equation as well, which gives us a lot more places to uncover what could be going on when it comes to difficulty conceiving.
Yeah, it's incredible. And I mean, like you just said, you hit the nail on the head, like they don't teach us that. So nobody, like, how would you know if you didn't deep dive into like all of the literature and research all of this? And I would probably guess that a lot of the OBGYNs don't know a lot of this as well, or they kind of have an idea about it. But like you said, they don't have the time to like teach or learn all of that because they're in the clinic seeing patients face to face, you know?
Yeah, that's a good point. I think there's two pieces to that. I think number one is the healthcare, you know, kind of by insurance model is not designed to allow for longer visits and to allow for something that's educational in nature. So even if the practitioner would like to spend that time, oftentimes they're not able to in the confines of the practice that they're in. So I think that's number one. And then number two, in many cases, OBGYNs, right, your obstetricians and gynecologists, they are pregnancy-focused practitioners. They're not actually fertility-focused practitioners. So if you think about the training that they've spent time on, it's really around pregnancy health. And it's not as much on the fertility side. So, you know, that is more the domain of reproductive endocrinologists, but reproductive endocrinologists oftentimes deal with infertility, not fertility. So there's a gap in care around this concept of fertility or proactive fertility, which is what we're calling pre-pregnancy wellness. We thought there was an opportunity for rebrand because right now fertility is almost always discussed in the context of infertility. And so there's an opportunity to think about getting pregnant and our baseline health before we get pregnant, whether it's a first pregnancy or a fifth pregnancy, as this new concept of pre-pregnancy wellness.
Yeah. And it's wonderful just getting your body ready to create a human.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Like, there's a lot that goes into it. So why would you recommend somebody get this testing?
Mm.
I think everybody should be doing this, but I want to hear what you say.
I'm also slightly biased. I do believe. So I think, right. So when you think about, a lot of times people ask me, like, are preconception tests or pre-pregnancy wellness tests the same as fertility tests? And the answer is no, because a lot of times fertility tests are used, as I've been mentioning, in the context of infertility. And most of the time, fertility tests are only focused on hormones. So they'll look at things like estrogen. They may look at things like testosterone. They'll look at your thyroid function. And that's important. But what's really important to recognize, particularly about sex hormones, is they're the most downstream thing in your body. So if your sex hormones are off, we have no idea why. They're downstream to your thyroid function, they're downstream to your adrenal function. So without testing thyroid function and adrenal function very holistically, we don't really have context for where the problem is. So what I would say is preconception or pre-pregnancy wellness testing is for everyone. Generally speaking, we define the pre-pregnancy wellness period as approximately 1 year before conception. But certainly it depends on your own starting point. And you know, spoiler alert, it's never too early to get started. And we also see a lot of clients who are coming in who are already struggling and undergoing potentially IVF or IUI, and they have already gone through a round or a cycle and it did not work. And so they want to get more insight into what might be going on so that they're better prepared for the next round. So that's another potential use case. And then there's also people who, I was just talking to someone this weekend who's about to freeze their eggs and is not sure about, you know, their starting point, even though they're doing it at a younger age, right? It just being younger doesn't necessarily mean that your eggs are in tip-top shape or in the best shape they could possibly be. And if you're going to be spending a significant amount of money on egg freezing, it can still behoove you to understand what your baseline is and to see if you can improve it before you go through a round of egg freezing, for example.
Yeah. And how, so I was just thinking, I know, like, we have our eggs inside of us when we're mm-hmm. inside of our mothers.
Mm-hmm.
And so they go through like everything that we go through. How long does it take to like improve egg quality?
I love this question. So first, right, what we know is always evolving. So I will share kind of what we know today, but just keep in mind, this is changing, especially as we have more research and more data on the topic. So right now, as we understand it, it's about a 1 year maturation period from, you know, the time the egg wakes up and is ovulated. And when I say wakes up, most of our eggs actually are existing in this, think of it like a sleeping beauty, like sleep state for a lot of our lives, right? So they exist, they're there, but they're in a state of suspended animation. And it's not until they wake up and start, you know, growing and dividing that they're more susceptible to what's going on in the environment around us. So it's particularly the 3 or 4 month window prior to ovulation that they're most susceptible to, you know, the environment around them. So that's what we're eating, our stress levels, the environmental toxins that are around us, for example. So all of these things. So what I would say is that's why we like to say around a 1 year period, right? So you can get maybe 2 or 3 cycles of egg maturation and improve the quality of eggs. And for males, it's about 3 months for new sperm to be produced. So again, right, ideally you want to get 2 or 3 cycles of that in to upgrade your sperm and upgrade your egg health.
Amazing. So like a year for women, 3 months for men, which makes sense. We do everything first. What is one thing? So if somebody's listening to this right now, what is one thing they can start doing today to like help improve their egg quality, improve their sperm if it's a man?
So I would say there's probably 3 big things I would be conscious of. And, you know, we're getting a lot of data back. So, you know, the more data we have, the more we can look at what the trends are. But I would say, you know, number one is around environmental toxins. Number two is around stress. And then number three is around nutrition. So around environmental toxins, and this is something, the reason I say this as number one is because it can take some time to start to do this. So environmental toxins sounds like this very dirty, complex word, but really we know that there actually are, you know, I think it's at last count 80,000 new chemicals that have been introduced into our environment in the last 50 or so years. And our bodies naturally detoxify, it's true, but our bodies were not designed to manage the volume of toxins that are coming at us on a daily basis. And when I say toxin, I mean basically just chemicals that can be in our food, in our water, in our air, in our personal care products, particularly our home care products, like the cleaning products that we use, the shampoos and the conditioners and the lotions and things like that. And a lot of, there's a class of chemicals called endocrine disruptors, and they, that's literally what they do. They disrupt your endocrine system, which is partly what's responsible for your fertility. So one of the first things that you can start to do is try to identify and eliminate as many endocrine disrupting chemicals as possible from your orbit, right? And this sounds super complicated, and it can be if you let it be. But what I generally recommend to people is just pick a room in your house and go one by one, right? So maybe you start with the kitchen. And you know, you work on that first, and then maybe you move to the bathroom, and then you work on that, right? And then maybe you move to the bedroom, for example. And that could be a more systematic way to work through eliminating things. And you know, a lot of these things, once you take them out of your body, they will be eliminated from your body. Some of them are more persistent, but that's a great place to start. So that's the first one. The second one, I'll say stress here. Stress is so misunderstood, but your sex hormones and your stress hormones are in the same biochemical pathway. And our bodies were designed to always prioritize survival over procreation. So if you are constantly stressed out, whether that's because you don't like your job, or you're living in a moldy house, or you're marathon training, and that's, you know, a lot of physical stress on your body, right? There's a lot of ways our bodies can experience stress. Then your body will divert resources from making your sex hormones to making stress hormones. So that is the connection where if you ever heard these stories about, oh, you know, I was trying for a really long time, and then when we stopped trying, we got pregnant, right? It sounds like a nice story, but that's actually the physiology behind it. So the practical suggestion here is just if you have recurrent, consistent stressors in your life, those are the ones that we'd want to either get rid of or reevaluate our relationship to. It's not practical to have no stress in our lives, and periods of stress is fine. That's, our bodies were designed for that. It's just these kind of like low level recurrent stressors that are constantly present that really drain our bodies. And then the last thing I would say is around nutrition. And you know, here we're just, you know, just as much as possible, adding in nutrient dense foods, I think, is a great start. So like lots of fruits and veggies is wonderful. Bone broth is a really nutrient dense food. I always try to put a plug in for liver because liver is a very nutrient dense food and no one really likes it. So that's another one I try to throw in. It's so good for you. And you can actually like mix it into hamburgers if you eat hamburgers. And that's a good tip for, you know, trying to minimize the taste of it as one potential option. So there's lots of options, but as much as possible, I think adding in nutrient dense foods, we can start to think about taking out less healthy foods for you, but as much as possible, starting with adding in the really good stuff, I think is a great starting point. So it's probably more than you bargained for, but those are the top three that come to mind.
No, that's fabulous. And I love that you focus more on adding in instead of restricting. And because I know, especially in like the endometriosis community and the infertility community, the restriction, they say like, oh, we go on the endo diet or go on all of these diets, and it's to restrict all of these things. And then it turns out that a lot of people have like a bad relationship to food now because of it, when you could just start adding things in instead to like level it out and make you just feel better.
Absolutely. I think, you know, having worked for a very long time as a nutritionist, I think, you know, and I'm trained as an eating psychology coach as well. There is that comes up, yes, around, you know, food restrictions. And I think it's so important. There's so many shoulds in health. And, you know, I really am conscious about not putting another should onto people. What I hope we can do with our work is give people informed consent around if this, then that, right? Here's what we know. If you engage in this behavior, then this is the likely outcome. If we have this test result, then this is the potential implication, right? And then you get to decide for yourself and for your family what makes sense, right? We are not here to give the, you know, this is the should. We're here to give you information so that you can make whatever choice.
Yeah. Informed consent. So you feel empowered in your health decisions.
Yep, absolutely. Because sometimes, right, I see this a lot, right? You know, sometimes with, particularly with food restrictions, there's, you know, an inflammatory response from food, but there's also a stress response if you're constantly obsessed about what you're eating and you're stressing about that. So, you know, sometimes it's actually better to eat the food and not feel stressed about it than to, you know, not eat the food and feel very stressed about it all the time. So for everyone, that's a different calculus. And, you know, looking at lab work helps us give a good indication of that as well. But it's always your choice. It's always your choice. What works for you. And by the way, what might be different, you know, when you're trying to conceive, it might be a different calculus that you're making than when you're managing your own health previously or after, right? So, you know, it can even change within your individual lifestyle over the course of the years, depending on your different goals.
Exactly. And sometimes what works for other people might not work for you, and what works for you might not work for other people. So it's very individualized.
For sure.
What are some of the like bigger issues that you see through the testing that's hindering people?
I was actually just talking with my team about this morning.
You?
So this is hot off the press, ladies and gentlemen. Yes. So I think one big one that we've been seeing a lot of, and it's part of the reason that we've decided to screen for it, is autoimmune conditions. So early signs of autoimmune conditions. We know that autoimmune conditions are 80%, you know, 80% of the diagnoses that are autoimmune are in females. So it's a disproportionately female diagnosis. We know that. And we also know that on average, it takes about 7 or 8 years to get an autoimmune diagnosis. So it is wildly underdiagnosed, especially because the symptomology is so nonspecific, right? So this was something that I saw in my clinic over and over and over again. I was seeing people coming in and you know, I was not diagnosing, but we have early screening tests that can be indications. And then you go on and do further testing with your doctor to confirm the diagnosis. But we're seeing very early indicators of autoimmune condition in a very large percentage of folks that are testing. So that's one thing that I think is, you know, really important to think about. Number two, I'm very surprised by this, but we're seeing large percentage of people with nutrient deficiencies. So vitamin D is a big one still. Even with all the talk and the testing about vitamin D, we're still seeing a lot of folks coming back with vitamin D deficiency. So that's another big one. And then ferritin is another one. So ferritin's a store of iron. So, you know, if you think about it, you may not be flagged for anemia specifically, but your iron stores are a bit lower. And since, you know, blood volume increases significantly in pregnancy, it's actually quite important to make sure that your iron stores are adequate before going into pregnancy. So that's another one that we're seeing a bunch of. And then one more, I think that, you know, we also see is metabolic dysfunction. And that's, you know, like insulin dysregulation or glucose dysregulation. We see a lot of that. And inflammation. We see, you know, hsCRP, which is a marker of inflammation, elevated. And so it's a nonspecific marker, meaning we don't know exactly what is causing the inflammation, but we know that your body is experiencing higher than normal levels of inflammation. We're seeing that flagged a lot. So those are some big ones. And, you know, all of the values that we're, you know, testing for are, you know, modifiable. There, it's not like genetics, right? Where, you know, you have genetics and there's nothing that you can do about the genetics. You can't change that. The markers that we're looking at are modifiable. Sometimes it's through diet. Sometimes it's through lifestyle. Sometimes it's working in partnership with your physician around a medication, right? Sometimes it involves a procedure. But these are things that once you know about them, you can start the process to start trying to address them.
Say somebody has all of those deficiencies, what do they do with their testing once they have it? Do they just bring it to their doctor and then work out a plan that way, or?
Yeah, so we, right now, we're offering, once you get your results, you'll get results in our web app. So say you go through the testing, you have a blood draw, then you get your results and you can look at your results on our web app, and it's going to explain to you, what is this marker? So like, you know, vitamin D, for example, what is it? And then what does it mean if it's low, for example? Or, you know, what is it, you know, for other markers, what does it mean if it's high? We explain the implication on your ability to, on ability to get pregnant and have a healthy pregnancy. And then you can also opt to have, as part of the price of the test, you can opt to have a call with one of our pre-pregnancy educators that can help contextualize the test for you. At this time, we're not offering medical services, so this is just an educational call, but it is a great jumping off point for as exactly what you said, for you to then, you can also download your results in you know, a PDF format to bring to your provider and to share with them what you've learned and to start the discussion with them. We have some really cool things in the works, which I can't quite talk about just yet, but I will let your audience know that, you know, we have some good stuff coming soon, and hopefully we'll be able to participate further along in the journey. But for right now, it's getting you those, that information so that you can advocate for yourself with your providers.
Yeah, it's amazing. Everybody needs to be doing this.
I agree. And both partners, by the way, I mean, we, you know, haven't touched on it too much, but this is one thing that I was really passionate about is, you know, I worked with a lot of female clients who were coming to me as a nutritionist, and they, you know, were in a couple of years into struggling to conceive. And I can't tell you the number of clients who would then come in and say, well, we just found out my partner has no viable sperm, for example. Or, you know, my partner has X problem that we are just finding out 2 years into fertility treatments, right? So I vowed to myself that that would not, you know, happen if I could, if I had anything to do with it, which is that biology does not care about our cultural construct that fertility is a female problem. It is literally a 50-50 biological equation. And this is regardless of your relationship construct. So when we think about this, whoever the reproductive partner is that you are going to be having children with, it's, you know, ideal. It's not a should, but ideally that individual will also be part of screening and a kind of understanding what their starting point is so that you can go through this process together and optimize your probability of success. Success being defined as not only getting pregnant, but having a healthy pregnancy and having a healthy baby.
Yeah. Yeah, infertility isn't just a female problem.
Yep, you said it.
I feel like almost all of the couples that I know that struggled with getting pregnant, it was also the male. Mm-hmm. Like they had very low sperm count or no sperm, like no, yeah. I don't really know the term for it, but mm-hmm. No sperm is what they told me.
Mm-hmm. But, yeah, it's more and more common. Yeah. So I don't know that a lot of people realize this. I always say I'm shocked that this is not more headline news, but sperm counts have dropped 60% globally in the last 40 years. So this is not just a US-centric problem. This is something that is happening across the world. A 60% drop in sperm count is a massive, massive order of magnitude. So that's to say our peers, our male peers, are, you know, less fertile than our grandparents' generation, which is absolutely wild to think of. So this is something that's happening across the board. And as we talked about earlier, new sperm are being created every 3 months. So there's so much agency that we have over that process. If we just know what we're working with, we know our starting point. And we're not measuring sperm count specifically, but you know, if folks come to us and they know that they have sperm count, what our test can do is help contextualize it. So to give them some understanding of what could be causing it. Is it inflammation or is it nutrient deficiencies or all these other things? So it can be a great adjunct to a sperm analysis to give you a little bit more insight into why it's happening. Because if your sperm count is low, oftentimes we don't know why. So a more broad look at your health can help us give us some areas to explore for what might be causing it, aside from anything that's structural.
That's incredible. So if it says that a man has low sperm count, it basically is a pathway to show them how to increase it.
Yeah, the goal is to give some context, right? And context says why, right? Because oftentimes you get low sperm count or you get issues with sperm morphology or motility, and there's no sense why. And so as I was saying, as well, you know, accepting structural issues like a varicocele, for example, which, you know, can cause problems like that, which you can get hopefully checked out with a physical exam from your doctor. Blood testing can be a good adjunct to understand what else might be driving these processes. Because a lot of times, you know, issues with sperm count can be due to, flow. Like if you don't have good blood flow, then that affects nutrient flow as well. So all of these things are connected.
Why is sperm quality better than quantity?
This whole quality versus quantity question. I think it applies to egg quality and quantity as well. Yeah. So I love that you asked this question. Let's take a look at this in the context of nutrition for a second, because I think this might appeal to your world a little bit. What I like to say is that, you know, this whole quality versus quantity debate or quantity versus quality is like the calories debate that we used to have in, you know, the 1980s, right? So for a really long time, we said, okay, calories are the only metric that matters. Calories are the king, the queen, the whole story when it comes to weight loss, right? And that was, you know, that was the dogma for a really long time. And then we said, oh, well, calories do matter, but like food composition matters and food quality matters and all these other variables, right? So I think we've gotten a much more holistic view of what matters when it comes to weight management, right? And I think we're going to see a very similar thing in the fertility space. And in fact, we're trying to shepherd that in. And I think you're starting to see indicators that that's happening, right? So quantity is only one metric, but quality is matters much, much more, right? Because you can have a small, oftentimes they do travel together, I think, and this is where it was confusing. You know, so a lot of times if you have compromised quantity, you will also have compromised quality when it comes to sperm count for sperm. And you may also see that with egg quality and egg quantity, but not always. And we mix up chronological age and biological age, which is, you know, this idea that like your age in years is not the same thing as the age of your cells, especially if you've been living your life particularly well or particularly intensely, right? On either end of those spectrum. So we don't always see that, you know, not all 30-year-olds are created equal, not all 35-year-olds are created equal, not all 40-year-olds are created equal. How you live your life really matters. And that's to your question earlier, right? Which is why that 3 or 4 month period times 2 or 3 matters, is because you can improve significantly the quality of your cells and therefore the quality of your eggs and your sperm. So I think quality is a much better metric. And for women in particular, right, you know, the data says that women have, you know, 10,000 plus eggs in their 40s. So this is not generally an egg quantity question. In fact, for 95% of women, egg quantity is a complete red herring. And quality is actually much more important, even if you want a really big family.
So do you think that egg and sperm quality has decreased over the years? Like, clearly, if the sperm counts are going down in the last 40 years, something's going on.
Mm-hmm. I do. So I believe that we are, you know, so there's this philosophy that we're living in an obesogenic environment, that, you know, the environment itself is predisposing individuals to obesity. And I think that has to do with a lot of things, like the food that is not food. It has to do with environmental chemicals. I also see a very similar pattern. I believe that our environment is infertilegenic, or I should say subfertilegenic, because infertile is just a medical diagnosis, meaning predisposing us to subfertility, challenges getting pregnant. And what that basically means is if you do not take action to undo the effects of the environment, you are very likely to experience, you know, obesity and or infertility or subfertility. Because we have to be active participants, or, you know, if you would like to avoid those fates, I should say, it's important to be an active participant, because our environment I like to say our bodies were designed to conceive, but our modern environment was not. And our environment has changed more in the last 50 to 100 years than it did in the last probably 10,000. And our genes are not adapted to our current environment. And that's why I think we're seeing a decline in health, a decline in fertility, and the, you know, the attendant things that go along with it.
Yeah, we're the sickest that we've ever been. I think I saw a statistic that said our children will be the first generation that won't outlive us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's, I mean, there are certainly indicators of that. And we are hoping to reverse that trend, right? That is so much what this business is designed to do, right? Because I think what we sometimes forget is this very important principle, which is that healthier parents give birth to healthier children. And the preconception window is such an important time period for you, for yourself, but also to set the stage for the foundation of health for your children. And what a lot of people don't realize, and I didn't even realize until I started researching this, was that, you know, a lot of health markers, so your epigenetics, the things that sit on top of your genetics, so the environmental influence on genetics, are passed to your children through egg and through sperm. So it's what you're doing in that 12 months before you conceive that actually set those epigenetic markers and set the lifelong, you know, trajectory of your child. Now, before we get too carried away here, right, this is not a condemnation. And if you didn't prepare and you already have children, like, I can already see people getting all concerned. Like, it's okay, right? We do the best that we can with the information that we have. And also realize, like, our bodies are incredibly resilient. And, right, this is where informed consent comes in, which is you actually have a high degree of control over setting the stage for your child's future health. And no matter what your starting point is, there is opportunities to do better from where you are. Now, you may have a genetic set point, and there may be things that you cannot change, but you have a lot more control and agency than you've been led to believe. And again, when I say control, I do not want to make it seem as though we can control every little piece. And, you know, that is not the level of control that I'm talking about. What I'm saying is you have agency over this process, and you can do a little bit better and a little bit better with information when it comes to diet and lifestyle and supplementation, for example. And all of these things in the preconception window pay huge dividends for not only you, but your future family.
Once you know better, you can do better. And I think your company does a really great job at helping people do that.
We're trying to.
Yeah. It's beautiful.
Thank you so much.
Do you have kids?
I do not. I have two amazing 13-year-old twin nephews who have taught me a lot about, well, certainly nature versus nurture. I've learned a lot from watching them grow.
Yeah. I only have nieces as well, but maybe one day.
Yeah. I'm a very proud auntie.
Mm-hmm. Number one aunt. Yes.
Yes, exactly. Auntie's one of the best roles ever.
Yeah, it really is. Making the world a better place for them.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Why aren't there other companies out there focusing on this? It seems like such a huge impact on just the world and our population in general.
I ask myself this question a lot, you know, and for a while when I was working as a clinician, I kept saying to myself, someone's going to figure this out. Like, someone's going to do this eventually. And I just waited and I waited and no one did. And that was the point at which I realized, oh, it's me.
Oh, I'm the person.
Yeah. Exactly. Oh, I'm the one who's going to do this. So that was humbling for sure. But I don't know the answer, but I have hypotheses. So I'll share my hypotheses. I think, you know, number one is this is a fairly new problem, like we were talking about, right? The level and velocity of infertility is fairly new in the last bit of time. And so it's a new problem. And so figuring out kind of what the solutions to the problem are, I think, like, we're still in the early days of figuring that out. I think that's number one. Number two is, I think, you know, watching in the clinic, I have a very different thesis on what the problem is. I think there are actually a lot of companies trying to address infertility, and there are incredible services really trying to address the financing around infertility, because it's exorbitantly expensive and there's very low access to care. I think, you know, there's a lot of companies that are trying to build community around people that are going through the struggle of infertility, because it can, you know, can be a very isolating and gut-wrenching experience for individuals. So, you know, I think there's a lot around that. And I think there are, you know, fertility clinics that are trying to, you know, improve outcomes with each round and gather more data and be more data-driven in their approach. So I think there's a lot of attempts and energy going on in the infertility space. But what I haven't seen is the question of why is this happening in the first place, right? Why is infertility rising? And how do we address this before it gets to the state where someone has been struggling for a year and, you know, they have to spend $10,000 to $20,000 to try to conceive times two or three because the success rate of IVF is only about 30%. So, you know, how do we address this problem before it becomes a problem? And, you know, what's causing the problem in the first place? And I think that's where we're focused. And that's a, you know, it's a much more complex question. And if you, you know, if you don't do, we're looking at a 70 biomarker test, right? So it's a massive amount of information. It's so multifactorial. So to really think that broadly is, you know, is something that's incredibly unique. And so I think it's a very different way of thinking about fertility. I also think that for so many years, we've thought about fertility as like the below the waist conversation. It's right. It's your ovaries and it's your testes. And like, that's kind of it. It's that and plus your hormones. Right. And that's just such a myopic view of what's going on. Your fertility is an extension of your overall health. So when we look, if we look at it like a microscope, like, oh, this is what's going on, then we miss part of the larger equation. So I think we've just been misattributing what's been going on, and we've not been looking at the full picture. And we're, you know, we're still in early days. So I believe that in the future, every couple is going to screen before they try to get pregnant. Like this is like, you know, just like everyone prepares to get to have a wedding, they're going to prepare to get pregnant. It's going to become part of the norm, but we're in the early days of letting people know that this is a possibility. And, you know, so excited to support people who this resonates with and are like, yes, like totally get it. It makes sense. I'm ready to go.
Yeah. And like empowering people and couples in their fertility journey. I agree. I think that in the future, it will be part, just, you know, everybody's idea of growing up, you know, I'm going to get married. Mm-hmm. I'm going to do my pre-pregnancy testing and then I'm going to get pregnant. And then
Exactly.
And we're going to buy a house or whatever they're like. Ideas, yeah, of
the next milestone is
the next milestone. There you go.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, because it's such an important part of just living in this modern world.
Absolutely. I think that what I'm seeing is we're getting interest as well, you know, from, as I was mentioning earlier, from folks that are, you know, younger and younger who are wanting to understand their pre-pregnancy wellness, you know, because sometimes the word pre-pregnancy wellness scares people off because they're like, well, I'm not exactly pre-pregnant. Like I don't really want to get pregnant in the near future, but pre-pregnancy is, you know, technically, right. We talked about the 1 year timeframe, but it can be any time before, you know, before you conceive. So I think it's interesting to think about, well, can I get my pre-pregnancy wellness baseline when I'm, you know, 20 or 25 or 27 or, you know, whatever it is, even if I'm a couple of years out from conceiving, if I'm, you know, either thinking about undergoing egg freezing or not. So I know what my baseline is. And then you can track that over time. And then you have a really good sense for things like, you know, we're, as I was mentioning earlier, we're seeing autoimmune conditions crop up. Well, it would be interesting to track that over time and to see, right? We know autoimmune conditions a lot of times can be triggered by life events. So it's interesting to see, okay, well, you know, there is no evidence of autoimmune disease here, but a year later there is. Okay, well, what happened in that time frame that could have caused that? And, you know, then we could start to address things much earlier in the disease process. And when you address things earlier in the disease process, you can use much smaller interventions, right? Much more elegant interventions. You don't have to use these big power tools, which I think IVF is. And power tools are great. You just have to know when to use them properly. If they're used on all people all the time, then, you know, then things can go awry.
Right. I wish that I had something like this, because I got diagnosed with endometriosis when I was 21. I just turned 21. And the doctor was like, well, you better get pregnant now because you'll probably be infertile unless you get pregnant now. Wow. And I'm like, okay, well, I'm 21. Like, I do not want a baby right now. I guess I'm just going to be infertile. And so I came to terms with like being infertile and like had this, I don't know, I guess I just like talk myself into thinking that I never wanted kids and I don't want them anyway. So it's fine because I'm infertile.
I'm so sorry.
And it would have been great to just get that, this testing done and to like get a true baseline on what's actually happening in my body instead of listening to some doctor, like put all this misinformation in my head. And I'm sure a lot of people listening have had that happen to them too, because it's something that happens in the endo community frequently, even though infertility is only about 40% of the population.
I'm so sorry to hear that. It's, you know, it's so infuriating for me to hear as a, you know, as a fellow clinician and as a fellow human, because it's, you know, not only is it just, incredibly insensitive, but it's just also not data driven. It's also just factually incorrect. Right. So, you know, I think what I hope people take away from this is a message of hope. Right. And I think, you know, to what you're saying, right. Can endometriosis be a factor in your fertility? And yes, it can. We know that it can. And are there lots of things that you can do to increase the probability of success and manage endometriosis well, so that there are fewer chances of complications around fertility? Yes, absolutely. Right. And you were talking about a bunch of them, right? There's a bunch of dietary interventions, right? Endometriosis is an inflammatory condition. So anything that we can do to reduce inflammation is also incredibly supportive, right? Anything that we can do to support, you know, the processing of adhesions, right? Sometimes that involves surgery. Sometimes, you know, we can think about, you know, if there are different ways to approach even just dealing with the physical adhesions through massage therapy or pelvic therapy, right? There's a whole bunch of different ways we can go at this. But I mean, someone telling you at 21 years old that you're going to be infertile, that's like a mind virus. That's what I would say. It's a
I agree.
Total mind virus.
When I didn't work in healthcare then, so I didn't really understand the back end. I just took what a doctor said as truth.
Because why wouldn't you?
Because you don't know when you're young and you don't work in healthcare and realize that doctors don't know everything. A lot of them are biased by their own, research and experience that are things that they've seen in their practice.
Yeah, I think it's such an interesting balance where you want to trust the healthcare providers that you are working with, right? You know, they are, in most cases, they're trying to do the best that they can. Right. I really do believe that. And as you said, there are limitations on their own knowledge, and there's also limitations on their own, you know, ability to provide care in the way that they would like to provide care. And right, it is, I think I see increasingly important for you to be your own advocate. And, you know, I see this even myself, you know, going to the doctor and, you know, the things that I need to advocate for. And to not just like, if you feel like something is wrong, something is wrong. Like full stop. There is no negotiation around that. And sometimes, you know, we were just talking about that with my team around, you know, autoimmune conditions and how, you know, early stages of autoimmune conditions may not be treated as seriously in the healthcare community until there's a later stage of disease. And I think that this is emblematic of a larger problem, which is in a lot of cases, we wait as a healthcare system until there's an overt problem, until there's extreme symptoms or something like infertility to address the problem. And that just seems so backwards to me. Why are we waiting so long to address these things? You know, it's such a better experience for the individual if we can identify things earlier and start to address things earlier, because as we were, you know, talking about, then you don't have to use such big interventions. And, you know, then they don't have 5 to 10 years of symptoms that they can't explain and they, you know, don't know what's going on and, you know, feel completely unheard. It's just, it's an unfortunate byproduct of the way that our, you know, insurance model works that, you know, we need diagnosis codes to run some testing, which is why, you know, I think part of the reason why we run the testing, like if you were to try and run the testing that we're doing outside of Poplin, I haven't seen anyone been able to get the full panel of tests yet. You might be able to get some subset of them. And, you know, certainly it's 10 times the cost if you were able to somehow manage to do that. So we're really trying to give people more agency over the process by at least getting the testing up front so that people have information.
Yeah, so that they can go into their doctor's appointments feeling empowered and not get bulldozed over by, oh, I don't know what's wrong with you. All your tests look normal.
Yep.
Or without even running any tests.
Mm-hmm. And I would also say there's like a difference too between like normal and optimal as well. Right. And especially in the preconception window. So, you know, one example that I give a lot is that thyroid function generally can have a broader range, but optimal thyroid function is much narrower. So optimal TSH, for example, in the preconception window is much narrower than for the general population. It's really important that thyroid function is dialed in. So, you know, there's even within the normal, you know, conversation, there's also this question of optimal. And ideally, as much as possible, you want to get into optimal ranges when you're trying to conceive, because it's a very nutrient intensive time period. And you want, you know, ideally want to be in as replete of a state as possible. So just the normal or kind of like the low end of normal, oftentimes, you know, may not cut it when it comes to, you know, creating an optimal pregnancy so that you feel great, so that your baby does really well, right? We're, you know, optimal is what we're aiming for, not just normal or common.
That is funny. And that's one of the things. So I have hypothyroidism. After taking Lupron years ago, I magically got hypothyroidism, but my numbers are like 5. And sometimes they're around 4, and, you know, depending on the doctor, they're like, oh, 5 is abnormal, but 4 is not. But the functional lab values, you know, you're supposed to be under 2.5. And that's a huge difference. I know, like, I feel so good when my TSH is that low compared to even like 3, 4, 5, which doesn't seem like that big of a gap, but it makes a huge difference.
That's such an excellent point. Yes. So I love that, you know, the lab ranges. Yes, this is great. I mean, we want it. Yeah, between 1 and 2.5 when we're looking at, you know, the preconception period, ideally. And as you said, right, some people will be able to palpably feel the difference. And, you know, some people will not. But it's important to understand that, because, you know, as we've been talking about here, right, like, and thyroid function is really important for early fetal development. So, you know, small differences in thyroid levels really can make a difference. So getting, you know, more information up front, especially if you know that you have had historical issues with thyroid, or you suspect you might be having issues with thyroid, it's a great time to get that checked.
Beautiful. Is there anything that you want to leave the listeners with?
I think we've touched on so many good
I know.
Pieces here. The only thing I would close with is, you know, something that I alluded to earlier, which is just, you have so much more agency over your health and your fertility than you may have been told. And that you can find out what's going on in your unique body by getting testing done and not relying on some random data table that says, you know, what an average 32-year-old or an average 34-year-old should look at. We can actually figure out what's going on for you. And then, you know, that gives you information to understand what your body needs, whether that's a supplement or whether it's dietary changes. And I think seeing the data on a page is a lot more empowering, because then you have this rationale for, why am I doing this? Why am I eating these certain foods? Or why am I taking these certain supplements? It's so much more empowering to tie it back to data about your own body than some nebulous recommendation that all women of childbearing age should do X, Y, and Z. Or all men of childbearing age should do X, Y, and Z. And so, you know, there can be just a closer linkage in the actions that you take with what's going on. And, you know, never accept patent statements about, you know, the ones that you received, right, about, you know, infertility. I think take, you know, all of these blanket statements with a grain of salt. And be an informed consumer. Do your own research and question everything, including what I am saying. Right. I think that's really important. I'm sharing a perspective here that is incredibly data driven. And I would also encourage you to be an informed consumer as well. So I think that's probably what I would say.
Amazing. And I can't imagine for people who are struggling with getting pregnant, like how affirming your testing can be for them. Like, oh my gosh, yes, this is why.
Yep. I have a reason.
I can do something about it, hopefully, you know.
Yep. Yep. I love that you said that. It is. It's great, you know, to kind of, you know, it's never great when you get not good health information or like, you know, health information that is not optimal. But from that perspective, from a, oh, now I know, or now I understand a pathway of something to do, right? That is very activating.
Yeah. Just bittersweet, but empowering.
Well said.
So thank you so much for creating this company and being a pioneer in the pre-pregnancy world. Like, it's amazing. Thank you for doing what you're doing.
Thank you so much. We'd love to support any of your listeners who want to get started on their pre-pregnancy journey. If they want to find us, they can find us at getpoplin.com, and we'll share a discount code with you for all of your listeners if anyone wants to get started as well.
Beautiful. And I'll put all of that in the show notes. I'll put all your links in the show notes. If you want to go take the quiz, get the testing, scroll down, get in the show notes and go do it.
Yep. You can do all the things.
All of the things. Yes. Oh, babe, thank you so much for taking the time to listen today. I had so much fun and I'm so fucking grateful for every single one of you. If you thought that this was helpful or you loved any part of this podcast, I would love, love, love for you to screenshot it and post it on Instagram at Chelsea Bri, ChelseaBri, and tag me. I would love to see what you're getting out of the episodes. It makes me so happy. I would also love it if you'd subscribe to the podcast and leave a review, because that just helps other wonderful endo babes find me as well. I adore you, and I believe that you don't deserve to feel like shit. You deserve to have a normal life despite endometriosis. So I love you so much, and I hope you have a wonderful day, and I'll catch you on next week's episode of the Endo Babe Podcast.